Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In the fully revised and updated edition of his book, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy and How to Save Yourself and Your Country, bestselling author and economist Peter Schiff details how we have not come close to fixing the problems that brought the U.S. economy to the doorstep of ruin in 2008, and that we are simply enjoying a government-inflated bubble. In his new book, he presents a dire and reluctant conclusion that is sure to cause a firestorm. America needs to restructure its debt or face an economic crisis infinitely worse than the one that occurred 5 years ago. It is a pleasure to welcome Peter Schiff back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me back.
You're an American investment broker, author, and financial commentator, and was a candidate in the 2010 Republican primary for the United States Senate seat from Connecticut. What brought you to re-examine this, to re-examine our perhaps coming bankruptcy?
Well, I decided to update my book. You know, the real crash I originally published in 2012, and a lot's happened since then to kind of impede the collapse and slow it down. And a lot of people have misinterpreted some of these events as meaning the Fed has been successful, that the Fed policy in the aftermath of the financial crisis of 08 actually worked and is bearing fruit, and the economy is recovering and everything is getting better. And the book is basically pointing out that none of that is true. It's all a fiction. In fact, the real financial crisis is the one that's in our future, not the one in our past.
How much do we know of what's going to happen in the future? I mean, when you look at it, how much of it is left up to if this happens, this happens, this happens, and how much of it is that you are certain that this is going to be in our future?
No, I am certain. I mean, I can't be certain of the exact timing of the events because there's a lot of variables that are impossible to to factor. But we do know from history that a major collapse is coming because for it not to happen would be unprecedented. I mean, we are doing things that other nations have done, and they've all succumbed to the same fate. And to assume that we're not going to suffer that fate, even though we've committed the exact same sins, would be a stretch. So from what I know about economics, from what I know about history, we're in a lot of trouble as a nation. And I do know that everything the Fed has done to solve the problems has simply made those problems worse. But in many cases, what they do numbs us to the pain as the problems get worse, and we push off the day of reckoning into the future. But there's a limit to how long you can do that, because every time you postpone it, you make it worse, and so the problem gets to be so big that at some point it simply cannot be postponed any longer, and you need to deal with it. And of course, since you've postponed it so many times in the past and you've made the problem so much bigger each time you've postponed it, it's so much more painful when you ultimately have no choice but to, grin and bear it.
I certainly want to get into the politics of this in a few minutes, but you spend a lot of the book talking about how one of the key problems here is the American consumer. A lot of this, a lot of the troubles that we have had, a lot of the troubles that will come, you believe, are on us.
Well, they're on us to an extent, but American consumers have been led astray by the government, by the central banks. Taxes have been very high, so Americans have had to surrender a high portion of what they earn to government, which means they have to survive on what government doesn't take. And so that, basically cuts the legs out from under the typical consumer. And now, as a result of inadequate incomes and inadequate income growth because of our highly taxed and regulated economy, which is a lot less productive than it otherwise would be absent all that government interference, people can't earn back the money that the government confiscates, so they've resorted to borrowing. And the borrowing has been heavily subsidized by the Federal Reserve with artificially low interest rates and government-guaranteed loans. So the government has first crippled the consumer and then encouraged him to take on debt. So the fact that we're now all broke is no accident. It is the byproduct of misguided government policies. So yes, the nation has been led astray, and you know, we're culpable because you know we borrow the money. But it's like, you know, it's like a drug user. You know, yes, he uses the drugs, but the pusher has a role in getting him hooked in the first place. And so, you know, this is very much a government problem and a Federal Reserve problem. Even though individuals have played a role, they were heavily induced to participate. Because absent all these government incentives, people are more frugal and more responsible. You know, you go back in time, Americans saved a lot of money. They didn't just buy things that they couldn't afford. They did do the right thing. It took a lot of bad government policy to get us to move in this direction.
And as you point out, that in an emergency, the average American really has no place to turn, and we live in a culture of bailouts and stimulus plans, which you argue only make the problem worse.
Well, yeah. I mean, every time the government bails somebody out, they prevent the market from fixing the problem. They just expand the problem. And the government stimulus doesn't actually stimulate the economy. What it really does is stimulate the problem. You can think of, you know, a drug addict who is, you know, coming off of his high. The drugs are leaving his system, and he begins to experience withdrawal. Well, the way to stop the withdrawal symptoms is to give the guy more drugs. And so you're stimulating him, and yes, you know, you're, you know, cutting short the withdrawal, but what have you done? You've just, you know, you've just drugged him up more. And so now you've made the problem bigger, because eventually the drugs are going to have to get out of the system, and then it's going to be more drugs to get out, and so it's going to be a bigger withdrawal. So whenever the government stimulates the economy, they're actually stimulating the problems that are hurting the economy while preventing the markets from solving those problems so that the economy can actually grow.
As I mentioned a moment ago, I want to talk about the politics of this. This is a bipartisan screw-up?
Well, yeah. I mean, the one thing that the Republicans and the Democrats have in common is they want to be reelected. And the way you get reelected is you promise something for nothing, and that's what they do. You know, the Democrats generally promise government programs for nothing, that we can have health care or education or all kinds of stuff, and it's not going to cost us any money. What the Republicans generally try to promise is tax cuts that don't cost anything, that we can cut taxes, but we don't have to eliminate any government programs in order to pay for that. So everybody wants to promise somebody something for nothing to get elected. And what nobody wants to do is deliver the bad news, right? Nobody wants to be the messenger who gets shot because they deliver a bad message. You know, nobody wants to bring the message of austerity and government cuts and, you know, we need to suck it up and bite the bullet and, you know, we need the short-term pain for long-term gain. Nobody wants to say that in politics. In politics, it's never about short-term pain, because that means you don't get reelected. The politicians only think in the short run, because every 2 years there's an election. So that's the time window that they think about. They don't think about 5, 10, 20-year periods, because that's not the election cycle. So they're not willing to ask a voter to sacrifice something today for a long-term benefit when they might not be in office when the long-term benefits come around. So for them, it's always kick the can down the road. What can we do? You know, extend and pretend. That's what they do. And it's not just the Democrats that do that. It's the Republicans. Everybody does it.
You ran for public office. How was your message received on the campaign trail?
Well, I didn't win, so. But, you know, I didn't get a chance to get my message out because I was outspent 10-1 by one of my primary opponents. And even though she outspent me 10-1, she spent over $30 million in the primary in a small state like Connecticut. She only got twice as many votes. And the other guy in the race was a career politician. And, you know, he got more votes than me in his own district. But I beat him in all the other districts. So my message didn't do that badly. And we don't know what might have happened had I gotten closer in the polls, because going into the race, like a couple of weeks before, I was polling in the low single digits. So nobody took me seriously, including people who wanted to vote for me. But when they counted the votes, I had 23%. So I actually had a lot more support than the polls indicated. And had people known I had more support, I probably would have gotten more media attention, and maybe my opponents would have been more worried about me, and so they might have run some negative attack ads against me. But as it stood, nobody ever attacked me. I had no negative ads against me. So we really don't know, you know, what might have happened if people really started to try to criticize my very controversial opinions, you know. So there's no way. I mean, I have a feeling that I really, you know, what I'm saying is it's a hard sell at the ballot box, because, you know, what I'm talking about works, but you have to understand it. And it's not necessarily going to work on a bumper sticker or on a sound bite in a 30-second commercial. You know, it's much easier for my opponents to vilify me and attack me on a bumper sticker. You know, he's anti-education, he's anti-environment, he's anti-women, he's anti-healthcare, he's anti-equality, you know, all these things that they can say I'm against. But it takes more space to show what I'm for, because I have to explain to people why the policies that they think are helping are actually hurting. So if I come out and I say I want to abolish government-guaranteed student loans and all federal government aid to education, people can say, oh, he's anti-education. He doesn't want people to go to college. It takes longer to explain why, no, I'm pro-education. I'm just anti-high costs for education and anti-big debt. And I don't want, you know, the governments to enrich the universities at the expense of the students, which is really what these programs do. They all backfire. They just run up the cost of college. They don't do anything about making college more affordable. They make it less affordable. And if anything, the government encourages people to waste money on college when they would be better off doing something else. So I have no problem with people going to college who would benefit from the experience. I don't want them to overpay for it. And I don't want people to go to college that gain nothing from it except a massive debt when they graduate.
Because one of the keys to your point in the book and one of the message that you believe in is that we need to stop spending above our means and we have to save more. And these are not necessarily things that the average American wants to hear.
Yeah, I mean, right now the economists want to say that what we need is more spending, that the government has to stimulate spending. I mean, we've spent ourselves into bankruptcy. You know, spending, you know, enough, you know, a lack of spending is not the problem. We've spent too much. What we really need to do is stop spending and start saving so we can invest again in capital equipment and we can actually have economic growth. But if the phony economy that we've erected is dependent on more spending, then the government wants to encourage that spending, even if it's undermining the long-term viability of our economy. But we have to recognize that we've overbuilt in certain areas and that we can't continue to misdirect consumption in order to prevent expose those overinvestments or malinvestments from what they are. We have to restructure this economy. We have too many stores. We have too many shopping centers, and we have too many malls. We don't have enough factories. You know, so we need to reallocate our resources, but just squandering more government money is preventing that from happening.
The name of the book is The Real Crash, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Peter Schiff, thank you very much for spending time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And again, the revised edition just came out, so it's now, you know, 444 pages. I've expanded the original book by about a third.
Fully revised and updated, it is The Real Crash, published by St. Martin's Press. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, great for having me on.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Real Crash. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.